All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. We're diving into a Supreme Court case today, and I know procedure can be a bit dry, but trust me, this one's worth it. We're looking at First Tier Mortgage Cup v. Investors Mortgage Insurance Cup, a case that really gets to the heart of when you can actually appeal a decision.
Yeah, it's about timing, right? Specifically those tricky, premature appeals. You know, when you think you can appeal, but turns out you might be jumping the gun a bit.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to unpack today. When is a premature appeal actually valid? We've got some great sources to help us with this, a detailed case brief, a more standard brief, and our own internal guidance document. So let's get into it. First things first, what was this whole case about? Where did it all begin?
Well, we have to rewind all the way back to 1983, Oklahoma. You've got First Tier Mortgage Co. financing home loans. And for 8 specific loans, they got mortgage insurance from Investors Mortgage Insurance Company, IMI for short.
All right, mortgage insurance, pretty standard stuff, right?
Yeah.
What was it about these particular loans that sparked this whole legal battle?
These weren't your typical loans. Let's just say there were some discrepancies, shall we, in the applications First Tier submitted to IMI. See, for all 8 properties, First Tier claimed a purchase price of $94,000, a down payment of $18,800, and a loan amount of $75,200. That puts you right at that nice 80% loan-to-value ratio.
Okay, very specific numbers there. What was the reality of the situation, though?
Oh, the reality was quite different. Turns out the borrowers didn't put down a single cent. The actual purchase price was only $75,200, the exact amount First Tier loaned them. That's a 100% loan-to-value ratio, not even close to the 80% they claimed.
Wow, that's a pretty big difference. Claiming a zero down payment is almost $19,000. I can see why that would raise some eyebrows, especially for an insurance company. So what happened when these loans, unsurprisingly, went into default?
Predictably, IMI was not thrilled. When First Tier submitted their claims, IMI refused to pay. They argued that First Tier's misrepresentations, basically lying about those key financial details, breached their contract.
Yeah, that makes sense. IMI saw it as, hey, you weren't upfront with us, so we're not obligated to cover these losses. So First Tier, obviously disagreeing, they took IMI to court.
You got it. First Tier filed a lawsuit in federal court claiming breach of contract. And they threw in a breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing for good measure.
All right, so the stage is set, the lawsuit is filed. What's the key procedural moment we need to focus on here?
Buckle up, because this is where it gets interesting. IMI files a motion for summary judgment. And on January 26, 1989, the district court judge makes a bench ruling. Basically, the judge verbally announces their intention to grant IMI's motion, signaling that they're siding with IMI without a full trial.
Okay, so it's a bench ruling, meaning this wasn't an official written order at this point, right? Just the judge saying, hey, I'm leaning this way.
Precisely. It was an indication of the judge's decision, but not the final word. The judge asked both sides to submit their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, their version of what should be in the formal judgment. And First Tier, they had the chance to object to IMI's proposals.
All right, so the judge has tipped their hand but hasn't made it official. What does First Tier do next? This is where the whole premature appeal thing comes in, right?
You got it. On February 8th, 1989, First Tier files their notice of appeal. But here's the catch. They filed it before the district court entered the official judgment, which didn't happen until March 3.
Whoa, hold on. They appealed based on the judge saying they intended to rule a certain way, not an actual judgment. Seems a bit hasty, Noam. What did the appeals court think about that?
The appeals court wasn't impressed. They dismissed First Tier's appeal, saying that the January 26th bench ruling wasn't a final appealable order because it hadn't been entered formally. It was all just talk, no official action.
So First Tier tried to get a head start, and the appeals court said, nope, not so fast. We need an actual judgment. But this isn't where the story ends, is it? Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about a Supreme Court case.
Oh, you're right. This is just the beginning. First Tier took this procedural issue all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court decided to hear it, specifically to clarify those gray areas in Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4A2, you know, how to handle those appeals filed before the judgment is actually entered.
Okay, so the Supreme Court steps in to lay down the law, to be the referee in this procedural game. What was the big question that we're trying to answer?
The question was this. Is a notice of appeal filed after a district court announces its decision, like that bench ruling, but before the actual judgment is entered, a valid appeal under Rule 4A2.
So it all boils down to how you interpret this one rule. How much weight do you give an announcement versus an actual judgment?
Exactly. And speaking of Rule 4A2, let's see what it actually says. The rule states that a notice of appeal filed after the announcement of a decision or order, but before the entry of the judgment or order, shall be treated as filed after such entry and on the day thereof.
Okay, so if I'm hearing this right, the rule itself acknowledges that there's this gap between an announcement and the formal entry, and it seems to allow for appeals filed in that gap. So the question then is, was that bench ruling the kind of decision that triggers this rule?
That's the crux of it. Mm-hmm. The appeals court said no, it wasn't final enough. First year argued, hey, it's pretty clear what the outcome was going to be. And the Supreme Court, they had to decide who was right.
All right, drum roll, please. What did the Supreme Court decide? Did they give first year a pass on their early appeal, or did they side with the appeals court?
The Supreme Court actually ruled in favor of first year. They said that their appeal was valid, even though they filed it before the formal judgment.
Really? So they were okay with the appeal being filed before all the paperwork was signed, sealed, and delivered? That's a pretty big deal. What was their logic behind that decision?
The court had a few key reasons. First, they looked closely at the bench ruling itself. They pointed out that it purported to dispose of all of first year's claims. Basically, the judge said, IMI wins, case closed.
So, because the bench ruling wrapped up the whole case, the Supreme Court said it was substantial enough to be covered by Rule 4A2, that it wasn't just a casual comment, but a real decision.
Precisely. The court said, imagine if the district court had entered the judgment right after the bench ruling. No one would question that it was a final judgment under 28 U.S.C. Section 1291. And for our listeners who might not be familiar with that, it's basically the law that gives appeals courts the power to hear appeals on final decisions from district courts, those that wrap up the whole case.
Okay, that makes sense. They're saying Rule 4A2 is there to prevent someone from losing their appeal rights just because they reasonably relied on what seemed like a final decision, even if the paperwork came later.
Right. It's about substance over formality,
especially
when the intent to appeal a final decision is crystal clear.
So it seems like they were focused on avoiding a technicality, getting in the way of a legitimate appeal. What else did they consider? Did they look at whether IMI was harmed in any way by this early appeal?
Absolutely. The court specifically noted that IMI wasn't prejudiced by the premature notice. They were in the courtroom, they heard the judge, they knew what first year was going to do. There was no surprise, no disadvantage to IMI in preparing their arguments for appeal.
So in this instance, nobody was really hurt by first year jumping the gun a little, but does that mean you can just appeal anytime a judge utters a word about a case?
Not at all, and the court made that very clear. Rule 4A2 has limits. It only applies if that decision would be appealable once it's actually entered as a judgment or order. It doesn't apply to interlocutory orders, those that only resolve part of a case, not the whole thing. Like, let's say a judge denies a motion to dismiss one claim out of many. You can't appeal that right away, and Rule 4A2 wouldn't save you if you tried.
Ah, okay. That distinction is key. It's not a free-for-all. So the crucial factor in first tier was that the bench ruling aimed to resolve the entire dispute. If it had just been about one piece of the puzzle, Rule 4A2 wouldn't have applied.
Precisely. It was that finality of the bench ruling, the fact that it was meant to dispose of all of first tier's claims, that made it qualify as a decision under Rule 4A2, and that all-important Section 1291 about final judgments. If there were any loose ends, any claims left hanging, the analysis would have been totally different.
Got it. Now, Justice Kennedy also wrote a concurring opinion in this case. What was his take on it? Did he agree with the majority's decision?
He did agree that first tier's appeal was valid, but he wrote separately to emphasize a subtle but important point about Rule 4A2. He argued that it doesn't just apply to decisions that would be final judgments under Section 1291. He said it can also apply to some non-final orders that are immediately appealable under a different law, 28 U.S.C. Section 1292A.
Right, Section 1292A, that's the one that covers things like appeals of injunctions, right? Orders that you can appeal even if the whole case isn't over because they have an immediate, real-world impact.
Exactly. Kennedy even gave a specific example. Imagine a judge orally announces they're granting a preliminary injunction. That's the kind of order you can appeal right away under 1292A because it forces or stops someone from doing something immediately.
I see. So if you appeal right after that announcement, but before the written injunction is entered, Kennedy says Rule 4A2 still protects you. You're not penalized for appealing what seemed like a final decision on the injunction, even if the paperwork lags behind.
Exactly. It highlights that the term decision in Rule 4A2 isn't limited to those big final judgments that end the entire case under Section 1291. It also includes some of those special immediately appealable orders under Section 1292A. It adds another layer of complexity, but also another layer of protection for those seeking an appeal.
So if we're thinking about takeaways, particularly for law students who are still wrapping their heads around all this appellate procedure, what are the big lessons from first year? What should they really take to heart?
Well, I think there are a few key points. First, this case shows us that finality isn't always about waiting for that piece of paper with judgment stamped on it. A bench ruling that clearly indicates the court's intent to resolve all the claims, that can be the starting point for the appeals clock, even if the formal judgment comes later.
That's a really important point. You can't just sit back and wait for the clerk to do their thing. You have to be paying attention to those rulings that essentially end the case at the district court level, even if they're not in writing yet.
Absolutely. Second, and this is huge, Rule 4A2 is like a safety net in the world of appeals. It's there to prevent you from losing your appeal rights if you make an honest mistake about the timing, especially when you're relying on what seems like a final ruling.
Right. It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card for those who genuinely thought they were following the rules.
Exactly. But, and this is a big but, it's not an excuse to be sloppy with procedure. You still have to be diligent. You still have to know when a decision is actually appealable and meet those deadlines.
So it's a safeguard, not a loophole. It rewards good faith efforts, not carelessness.
Exactly. And lastly, remember what Justice Kennedy emphasized. Rule 4A can reach beyond just those final judgments under Section 1291. It might also apply to those specific types of interlocutory orders that you can appeal right away under Section 1292A, like injunctions.
Right. It's about looking at the bigger picture, not getting tunnel vision on just the final judgment.
Yeah. Always ask yourself, if this decision were entered right now, could I appeal it? If the answer is yes, then even if it's not a final judgment on the whole case, Rule 4A2 might come into play.
So the big takeaway from first here is this. Yes, filing on time is crucial, but a slightly early appeal, one based on a clear decision that would have been final if entered right away, can be saved by Rule 4A. It's about finding that balance between following the rules and making sure people with a legitimate reason to appeal don't get shut out because of a minor timing issue.
Perfectly put. It highlights the practical side of litigation. The moment when you can reasonably say, okay, the district court is done with this case, even if the formal paperwork hasn't caught up yet.
This has been a fascinating dive into first tier, a case that really emphasizes the importance of understanding those procedural nuances, those little details that can make a big difference in the world of appeals. And it makes me wonder, as legal issues get more complex, as we have more and more procedural options, are there other scenarios where Rule 4A2 might pop up in unexpected ways? Something to ponder as we navigate this ever-evolving legal landscape. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
Until next time, everyone.